It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Now we're going to turn to analysis of the verdict in the trial of Lieutenant Brian Rice, who was acquitted on all of the charges he'd faced in connection to the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Monday morning, Judge Barry Williams issued his verdict to a packed courtroom in Courthouse East on Calvert Street in downtown Baltimore. Prosecutors from the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office have yet to achieve a conviction in any of the four trials that have taken place so far. Rice's acquittal follows a hung jury in the case of William Porter, who's scheduled to be retried in September, and the acquittals of Officer Edward Nero and Officer Caesar Goodson. Lieutenant Rice was the highest-ranking officer to be indicted in this case. So what, if anything, was different about this trial? To unpack what happened in the courtroom and for insight into why Judge Barry Williams made the determinations he did, we're joined once again by our legal eagles, Edward Smith and David Jaros. Edward Smith is an attorney in private practice. He served in the office of the state's attorney, and he's argued cases in front of the Supreme Court. David Jaros is an associate professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, whose scholarly focus is on criminal law. He's been in the courtroom for the verdicts in all three of these bench trials and when Judge Williams declared a mistrial last December. Good morning again. Good to see you guys.
Good morning, Tom. Great to see you.
So on the 24th page of Judge Williams' verdict, he writes the following. He says, failing to seatbelt a detainee in a transport wagon is not inherently criminal conduct. I'm no lawyer, but it seems to me that that's at the heart of the prosecution's contention in all of these cases, Ed Smith. I mean, what does that statement mean, and how will it have an impact on the theory of the remaining cases going forward?
Well, it may be negligent conduct, which is a lower standard than reasonable doubt and criminal culpability for the actions of failure to seatbelt. I think from the beginning we indicated, both Dave and I, that this was an uphill battle for these prosecutors, but they had to trudge on because there was, in fact, probable cause for what they wanted to do. That doesn't mean that they haven't proven negligence. They probably have in a civil case, but that's a case which has already been decided by the mayor and others deciding that they would settle the case. Negligence is negligence. Yeah. It's not criminality necessarily.
Yeah. And I mean, David, in this trial, you've been there for all of them. Is this kind of, you know, deja vu all over again? Did they argue the same case in the Rice case as they did in Nero and Goodson?
You know, each case has small differences or perhaps significant differences. The fact that this was the senior officer on the scene, and Lieutenant Rice was the officer who actually was the one who lifted Mr. Gray into the van and was in the person who was in the best position to secure him at the second stop. And that was a critical difference, but it wasn't enough here. You know, the other issue in each case is that with the exception of Officer Goodson, every officer has made a statement. So that statement is evidence that will be available in the trial against that particular defendant. So we don't know what Officer Miller's statement is. We don't know what Sergeant White's statement is. So each case potentially has a little bit of different evidence, but the truth is we have seen the same story each time, and it hasn't been enough.
Ed Smith, the judge also writes that Lieutenant Rice's decision not to seatbelt Mr. Gray must be viewed from the perspective of the context of the emotions that were running so high at the corner of Mount and Baker at that moment and on that morning. What does that mean? I mean, is that again have to do with the bar that it takes to prove criminality?
Well, I think that there's a certain amount of discretion that police officers have when they're on the scene and there is a crowd that is gathering and the crowd becomes hostile, as one gentleman who was taking photographs of the matter was cursing and who was acting totally out of frustration and perhaps anger. Police officers have to watch their back on the street. And the question then becomes, is he using a reasonable discretion in order to prevent harm to himself, the officers who are on the scene, and to prevent something from going far beyond what he has to deal with?
So there is a pretty wide latitude that officers are given in all of these cases.
There has to be, because they have to make sure that people are peaceful. And when people act out and they act crazy and they act unreasonably, even at the scene where they think something is going wrong, this should be a lesson to us all to act in a cool, calm way so that we can get to the bottom of it and get the facts so somebody can do something.
Yeah, Dave, what do you think?
To add to that, part of the focus on Lieutenant Rice's perspective is because of a very important part about the standard for his mental state for this to be a criminal act. There's both an objective and a subjective standard here. The objective part is that he has to act unreasonably. But the subjective part is he has to be consciously aware of the risk he's putting Mr. Gray in and aware that he is acting inappropriately. And that was the highest hurdle in this case. And at the end of the day, I think the focus on what the judge could find beyond a reasonable doubt what was going on in Lieutenant Rice's head became a critical thing.
That's David Jarosz from the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's joined here in the studio by Edward Smith, an attorney in private practice. You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1 WIPR. Ed, explain another thing to me. The judge said that the state didn't show that Lieutenant Rice had actually read the directives about the seat belting and the regulations that the police have about what you're supposed to do with defendants. They were relatively new regulations. They'd only been out for a week or so. So there was no evidence that he knew about the changes in the regulations. Mm-hmm. Is ignorance of the law or ignorance of the regulations a defense in this? This struck me as kind of strange. I mean, if they stopped me for not wearing a seatbelt in my car and I could just say, oh, I hadn't heard of that law, does that get me off? I don't think it does.
Well, that's because it's a law. Regulations, at least these police regulations and SOPs is what they're called, standing operating procedures, are not a law. You know, for instance, that there has been a law passed that makes you, Tom, liable if you don't put on a seatbelt. Here, the situation is this. They could not prove that he had the necessary scienter or knowledge because no one, the state could not prove that he actually read it or received it or was in fact, and remember, they were prohibited as a result of not providing the discovery that they should have provided from bringing his knowledge about this seatbelt and what he was trained in as a lieutenant and as a supervisor into the trial. So that was one thing which either they or the state or some agency caused them to be shot in the foot about.
Mm-hmm. And Dave Jarosz, you were in the courtroom for that. That seemed like a remarkable moment. I mean, was that just a big mess up on the part of the prosecutor?
You know,
or was that a discretionary call that they made?
Well, I think it's important for people to know what the discovery violation, as it was called, really was. So they're in part of their effort to prove that Lieutenant Rice was aware of the dangers of failing to secure Freddie Gray, they plan to introduce some of the curriculum from the classes he took or trainings he participated in after he came out of the academy. And so this 4,000 pages of documents was actually the class curriculum that they had requested from the police. They got that very late in the process, and so they turned those papers, 4,000 pages of documents, over to the defense right before trial. And the judge said, no, you had to get that much sooner since you didn't get it quickly enough, I'm not going to let you use it. Now, at the end of the day, it might have been helpful for showing that Lieutenant Rice really understood the dangers of not seatbelting, but I honestly don't believe that it was a turning point in the case. If anything, if it has value, from what I understand from defenders in the state, is that prosecutors regularly turn over discovery very late, sometimes walking into trial. And that's a big issue that the criminal justice system has to deal with. But I don't think this was a mistake that changed the course of this case.
So the next trial is the trial of Officer Garrett Miller. He also faces a charge of reckless endangerment, 2 counts of second-degree assault, and 2 counts of misconduct in office. At least that's where the charges stand at the moment. They could change. I mean, as we saw in Lieutenant Rice's case, one of those charges was dropped right at the very beginning of the trial. Another one was dropped by the judge in the middle of the trial. So who knows what will happen once the trial gets underway. It's scheduled to begin on the 27th of this month. What do you think the verdict in this case and the prior cases is going to do to influence the prosecution's strategy going forward?
If I was a betting man, I'd say that they should fold their tents and go home about now. And it seems to me there is no shame in doing your best, putting forth everything that you have, and giving it a try. And I think that's what has happened. People wanted a vindication of something. They wanted something that they can hold on to. And you know, I think that you've had us here enough. It's time for all of us to move on, including the citizens and including Freddie Gray's family and everybody else. And we need to move on to the future. We got a lot to do.
Mm-hmm. And you don't think finishing the job, going through with the final prosecutions of the officers who've yet to face trial, at the very least, perhaps they don't retry Officer Porter, but you know, going through the process with these other two would, in other words, if they didn't do that, if they were to drop things at, right now, would that, could that not be interpreted as giving up?
Foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, someone once told me. And I've tried to live by it.
Yeah. Well, Dave Jones, I mean, there are a couple of things that are a little bit different in the Miller trial. One of them has to do with the knife that was that Mr. Gray was carrying at the time. And I guess Mr. Miller has withdrawn his request to block from the trial a discussion of the knife. So they've changed their mind about the relevance of the knife. What does that indicate to you?
So the charges in this case have morphed over time, and the prosecutor's theory of this case has changed over time. The charges against Officer Miller are very similar to the charges that were made against Officer Nero. These were the two officers who initially detained Mr. Gray and found the knife on him that we've heard so much about in the press but actually have heard very little about in court. And the truth is that the prosecution has a very novel theory of assault for Officer Miller, because they've had to essentially, we've talked about this before, concede that the police had the initial authority to detain Mr. Gray. And that once they found the knife, they have apparently conceded that at that point there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Gray. So they have to essentially show that in the few minutes between that initial detention and the time when they found the knife, that the officers were not diligent enough in confirming their reasonable suspicion. That's getting very deep into the weeds of the law, I know. But at the end of the day, I think it is a very, very difficult legal case to make.
And Ed Smith, one of the things you've done in your varied career as an attorney is you've defended police officers when they go before an internal review at the
trial board.
Officer Miller and Officer Nero have been on administrative duties with pay throughout this entire situation. The other four have been suspended without pay.
Felonies.
We learned the other day, and that's because of the nature of the charges that they faced. So we learned the other day, for example, Officer Goodson will collect back pay now that he's been exonerated.
Yes.
And it's expected that Lieutenant Rice will as well. Mm-hmm. But their troubles are not by any means over
In
terms of their continuing a career as a police officer.
Yeah, that's true. But they can be terminated by the recommendation of the trial board and obviously by the commissioner, and they have a right to appeal from there. So we'll hold that chapter open, and when it happens, we'll see what happens.
Is the evidence kind of going to be the same? You know, I mean,
standard is different. Mm-hmm. That's the issue. The standard is something that is far less for a firing or disciplinary action before the trial board, and consequently, they have an uphill battle.
Well, Ed Smith, Dave Jarris, always good to see you guys, and we will undoubtedly have you back again to talk about who knows what.
Well,
you know?
I hope not, but
Your Honor, I must disagree with you. It's always good to see you. All right, thanks, you guys. Attorney Edward Smith has served as both a prosecutor and a defense lawyer. David Jarris is on the faculty of the University of Baltimore School of Law. WYPR's Metro reporter Kenneth Burns has been covering all of the trials of the officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. stay tuned for Kenny's continuing complete coverage here on 88.1. The next trial, scheduled to begin 1 week from today, July 27th, when Officer Garrett Miller will face a charge of reckless endangerment, 2 counts of second-degree assault, and 2 counts of misconduct in office. At least those are the charges, as we mentioned, that State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby announced back in May of last year. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later in the broadcast, a conversation with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel. We'll talk about foods that may help to prevent Alzheimer's disease. But first, it's time for our weekly feature, The Environment in Focus.